Professor Dana Peterson is particularly interested in the debate over whether gender-specific or gender-neutral theories of and responses to delinquency and youth gangs are necessary. Exactly what is this debate and why does it matter to us? We'll find out in just a moment. Hello, everyone. My name is Pamela Brewer, and I am welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk, and welcome to Professor Dana Peterson. Dr. Peterson, welcome.
Thank you very much, Pamela. It's really good to talk with you.
Now, I was going to share with the audience your list of accomplishments, but it's only an hour program. So instead, I will simply say that you are an associate professor at the School of Criminal Justice at the University of Albany State University of New York. Dr. Peterson, is there more that we should know about you as we engage in our conversation about gangs?
Sure, I can tell you a little bit more. I've been here at the University of Albany since 2002, and I've been doing research on young people and their involvement in violence and delinquency, juvenile justice, and particularly in gangs, since about 1995. And so I have a variety of perspectives, a variety of experiences in terms of the ways in which I've conducted my research, and I can certainly share all of that with you as much as we have time for. And I look forward to our conversation.
Well, you are doing work clearly on youth gangs, as I mentioned. How are you defining a gang?
That is one of the debates, actually, in the field, both with practitioners and with researchers. And how we define gangs actually determines what gangs look like, how many there are, and who is involved in them. One of the common ways that both law enforcement and researchers approach the subject is to ask young people themselves and ask them to self-identify if they would say that they are members of gangs. And so in much of our research, we will allow the young person to define that. And law enforcement typically will do the same thing. But in addition, we also try to get some verification. We try to ask additional questions to find out what is the nature of the groups they belong to, what are their roles in the groups so that we can really understand their levels of involvement and how we can respond to that. One of the ways in which we measure this, according to a national or international consortium of researchers that's called the Eurogang Research Program, is we use a general definition of street gang that looks at a group of young people who have been together as a group for some period of time, so there's some level of duration over time, and they are street-oriented in that they're not private groups. They are somewhat outside to be seen in the public. They act in the public, and they have some kind of group identity that is, if not involved in delinquency, at least somewhat accepting of involvement in delinquency. And that, what we call Eurogang definition, structures much of our international collaborative work so that we can understand and look at the same kinds of groups across space and time. And that that definition would apply to many of the groups and people that I study as well.
When we talk about youth gangs, what age range are we talking about?
The average age of what we would consider street-oriented gangs tends to be in mid-adolescence, 13 to 14, up to the early 20s. And we find that a really prevalent age of gang involvement is unfortunately around age 14. And that's to be found across the country in a variety of self-report studies. We find that the peak age, that the time at which many young people are involved, is around age 14. But we do see young people joining in late childhood, as early as 10 or 11 years of age. And many of them aren't involved for very long. We tend to see that adolescents will cycle in and out of gangs within a year or two. So it's not necessarily, you know, stereotypically the blood in, blood out, lifetime kind of involvement. Certainly there are people who do maintain lifetime involvement, but typically we see a shorter duration of gang involvement.
With the younger children?
Yes.
You heard me say a moment ago in introducing you that you were interested in the debate with respect to gender-specific or gender-neutral theories. Why does that matter? What exactly is the debate?
That's something that's been really in play since about the 1970s, when we really started to recognize that young women are themselves involved in delinquent and violent activity, and we've had a variety of theories about that. But historically, when we've responded to delinquents and criminal offenders, we respond to young women who are involved in the same ways as young men. Historically, we had women housed in males' facilities. We didn't have any divisions for young women, and that subjected them to a lot of victimization within facilities, as well as the fact that some of their specific needs were not being met. And when we started to look and recognize that perhaps young women have different needs and recognize that perhaps we should separate women and children from men in our facilities, correctional facilities and other types of detention facilities, we kind of swung the other way in terms of really thinking that we need completely separate types of responses, that women have completely separate kinds of needs than young men do. And so we would focus activities and facilities around gender difference as opposed to gender similarity as we did previously. And I think now we're really more seeing a balanced approach where we recognize that we do need, we can use some of the same strategies, some of the same programs for both young men and women, but that we might need to be gender sensitive in specific areas and provide specific kinds of approaches for some needs that might be gender specific. And that's I think, where we're going now and starting to understand and integrate those kinds of things. And that's where the research is right now in terms of defining exactly what those commonalities and what those differences are.
I know that there's at least one person who will listen to our conversation and who will say to themselves, if that child is a member of a gang and that child is now incarcerated, why do I care about whether or not his or her needs are met? All I care about is that they're off the street. What do you say to that person?
Yes, I think that's a very common sentiment. When we conceive of gang members as victimizing communities and gang members as striking fear in communities such that residents don't feel comfortable going outside and enjoying community life, I think that's a very common kind of response, that they should be removed. We don't want to hear from them. We believe that punishment is the right strategy. And while I think that there's definitely accountability that needs to be had, I also think that if we have a broader understanding of what brings young people to gangs, and also conceiving of them as victims as well, and that's not something that we commonly think of when we think of gang members. We think of them as being victimizers, and we don't look at the flip side that many gang members are actually victims themselves, and that could be from early childhood, some family or neighborhood experiences with victimization, or that because of their lifestyles, they tend to bring victimization on. Victimization, we know, has a lot of effects in terms of trauma and the effects of trauma on the brain. And if we don't try to remedy these effects, we don't necessarily have lifetime without parole kinds of sentences for a lot of these young people, especially if they're handled in the juvenile justice system. They're going to be coming back out into our communities in their early 20s or late teens. And I think it would serve us well to be able to figure out how we can address their needs so that they can better reintegrate into their communities and be able to contribute in valuable ways to their communities. So while I think that certainly we need to hold young people accountable for their actions, I think we should also ask ourselves, what can we also do to help and make sure that they are contributing members of their communities once they rejoin us?
So indeed, in helping them, we're actually helping ourselves and our society.
Yes, that's my perspective, and I think something that's shared by a lot of people who do research and work with these young people. We can see them as individuals and believe that they have something of value to offer.
You know, we hear certainly more and more these days about teens who kill, whether it's planning a mass murder at a school or killing parents or whatever. Do they tend to be, do the teens who get involved in that kind of violence, do they tend to be members of a gang, or do they tend to be solo actors?
From what I understand, and I my research is not necessarily on school shootings and other mass kinds of killings, but from what I understand from the research and from the media reports on that is exactly that, that they're not necessarily members of gangs. They do tend to be more lone offenders who have some kind of grievance or have had some kind of experience that they are reacting against. And the violence that we see in the killings within and among gangs, most often, not always, but most often is either within the gang or between gangs. And we all hear, of course, that there are innocent bystanders who are caught up in gang violence, or family members or friends of gang members who are targeted by rival gang members in order to send a message. But we don't tend to see gangs engaging in these kinds of mass amounts of violence, the mass shootings. There certainly have been cases where the gangs have shot up establishments. For example, in Chinatown in the 1970s, one of the Chinese gangs went into a rival gang's territory, which happened to be a Chinese restaurant, and there were many tourists who were having dinner, enjoying a meal, and the rival gang came in and just started shooting, and you know, many of the tourists lost their lives. And so we do see incidences like that of mass shootings, but it doesn't tend to be something that that we would associate with gangs and gang violence.
Okay. And when you say Chinatown, are you referencing Chinatown in New York City?
Sorry, yes, good question. That particular incident took place in Chinatown in San Francisco.
Okay. All right. The idea that girls could be gang members and that girls could be violent. I mean, I know that we know that that's possible, but it still seems like there are at least some portions of our society that when they hear or see about girls beating each other up or behaving in quote unquote unladylike ways, it seems to be such a rare and odd thing for the viewing public. Is it unusual for girls to be in gangs?
Statistically, actually, for a general adolescent population, it's actually rare for any young people to be involved in gangs. But we see percentages across a variety of studies that use self-report information from young people themselves, studies that have been done across the United States. We tend to see that in general samples of young people, so middle school or high school samples, for example, 2 to 4% of female adolescents will be gang involved. And that is about half of the number or percentage for young men. Approximately 6 to 8% of young men in a general adolescent population will be gang involved. So we don't see statistically, and actually I say that, but some people when I quote those statistics think that's kind of high, because that does mean that there are quite a few in number who are gang involved. So I think statistically it's a rare event in general, but we do see young women involved in gangs. And if we flip the statistic, if we actually look and ask the question, what proportion of gang members are female, we see a bit of a different number. When we look again at these self-report studies, we see that of gang members, females make up approximately 1/3 across the studies that we have. And that will range from 25% to almost 50% of the gang members in any given sample. So while it's a small proportion of female adolescents who are involved, it's actually quite a high proportion of gang members who are female. And I think that number probably surprises people.
Absolutely.
We I think we tend to see gangs as very masculine, very stereotypically masculine and even hyper-masculine. They're very aggressive environments, and they have a lot of masculine traits. And so when we think of young women, we think of them, you know, stereotypically in terms of gendered notions. And you mentioned the term ladylike. We have our stereotypical notions of what it means to be ladylike, and it means to be more passive and polite and quiet and maybe not weak, but certainly not, you know, physically aggressive or strong. And those notions do not go along with our stereotypical notions of what gangs are and who are in gangs. And so I think it is antithetical to how we think of young women and who they should be. And that's a historical notion. Even back in the, you know, early 1900s, we have documentation of young women in gangs, but they're either described as very masculine, wearing masculine clothes and engaging in violent activities and fights, or they're described as very sexualized. They're sexual beings. They're there for the pleasure of young men who are in the gang. And I think those two notions have followed the descriptions of young women over time who are involved in gangs. And when we start talking to young women, we start to see a little bit of a different picture emerge in terms of their roles and their activities.
You talk about the fact that based on your research of females in gangs, that in some gang cultures, the women, the girls, are actually very powerful and, in fact, responsible, and I'm quoting now, for a good deal of the violence perpetrated by these groups.
Yes.
Again, that fits with what you've just said, but certainly does not fit with the quote-unquote expectation, if you will, of society at large.
Yes, and that's, again, depending on who you talk to, you get a different picture of what women's roles are in gangs. Much of our historical accounts were written by white male researchers, and the white male researchers tended to focus their research efforts on males in the gangs. And so if we heard any descriptions of females, it was through the perspectives of male gang members or through male gang researchers. And so we tended to see those two kinds of descriptions. Either they were, you know, more tomboys, they were just like the men, or they were, you know, there for sexual pleasure. They were sexualized. And once we started to get into the 1980s and started to see a proliferation of research that was really focused on young women, researchers started to talk to young women and hear their voices. And at that point, we started to see a different picture. And my current research that I do, I look at young women's roles in different types of gangs, because I think we also can't essentialize, we can't generalize across females and think that there's just one experience that females have within gangs. One of the distinctions that we found in my co-authored research is if we look at gangs of differing sex composition, women tend to have different roles within those gangs. And one of the biggest distinctions that we see is for young women who are in majority male gangs. So there's just a few females, but most of the gang members are male. Those young women have different experiences than gangs in which there are a good number of females, where the gender difference is about 50-50. So there are a lot more females and fewer males. And what we find is that females in majority male gangs tend to have a little bit more freedom in terms of engaging in the typical kinds of activities that we think of with regard to gangs. And by this, I mean things that give status within gangs, committing criminal acts on behalf of the gang, becoming involved in violence, and that could be assaults, it could be robberies, it could be drive-by shootings. In gangs where there are just a few females, those females have a little bit more freedom to engage in those kinds of activities, and they do. In one recent paper, we found that actually females in majority male gangs are even more, they're more frequently violent. They report more frequent engagement in assaults, aggravated assaults, robberies, and gang fights than even the young men who are in majority male gangs. So then we turn to sex-balanced gangs where the gender distribution is more equal. And in those gangs, we find that the activities of young women are suppressed. They're not as they don't have as much freedom to engage in those status-enhancing activities. We turn to organizational sociology to try to understand this, and in studies of organizations where we look at men and women in corporations, for example, or in traditionally male-dominated employment like law enforcement, we see similar kinds of things. We see that when there are just a few females, they're kind of seen as one of the guys. Nobody really pays attention to what they're doing, and they are free to engage in the kinds of activities that garner status or professional development or promotion within those professions. When we see corporations where there starts to be an increase in the number of females in that profession, we start to see that males engage in strategies to reduce females' ability for promotion. In law enforcement, females might be shunted into other divisions like children and family issues, where they're dealing more with things that are women's roles.
Dr. Peterson, let me interrupt you. We need to take a break, but when we come back, we will pick up right here. This is absolutely fascinating. Don't go away, folks. We'll be right back. Dr. Peterson, it's so interesting to hear you draw comparisons between the way corporate structures interact in terms of male-female ratios and gangs. I mean, it almost sounds like gangs are kind of like mini corporations.
In some ways, yes, I think there are some parallels to be drawn. I think a lot of our adolescent street gangs, the ones that are most common in the United States, aren't quite as organized and hierarchical, but there's certainly some of the same group processes and group dynamics that go on within gangs, for sure.
What motivates an entry into a gang? Is there a gender difference there?
That's a very complicated question, I think, because it depends on the kinds of things that we look at. There have been a lot of research that looks at general patterns, so looking at data from nationally representative samples of young people in the United States. So these are quantitative data that give us really good information about the breadth of a problem. And through those kinds of surveys, we can look at things that are risk factors. What kinds of factors do young people face in their lives that might propel them, that might create a greater propensity for them to join gangs? And in the risk factor research that we have thus far, we don't see a lot of gender differences. We see a lot of similarities. And there are several factors that tend to be common across these studies. Factors like having a lot of negative life experiences, abuse in the home, the loss of a parent through death or incarceration, for example, the breakup of a family. So negative life events are a factor that creates a greater likelihood of joining a gang. There are peer factors, so the extent to which young people hang out with peers who are deviant and the extent to which they are bonded to or have affective bonds with those peers. this is coupled also with the ability of their parents to kind of monitor the situation and see who their children are hanging out with, how they're spending their free time. If they're spending free time hanging out unsupervised, young people tend to get themselves in trouble when they are hanging out with nothing to do and no adults are around. So those factors tend to be common. In addition, there are some constitutional factors, such as a young person's tendency towards impulsive behaviors or lacking self-control, and those factors tend to predict a greater likelihood of gang joining. We don't see, as I mentioned, too many sex differences in terms of the risk factor research. We see that if there are differences, it tends to be in the realm of school. So the school factors such as lower commitment to school, not being attached to adults at school, or low academic performance tend to be stronger predictors for young women, actually, than for young men. So the risk factor research, we see a lot of similarities. If we ask young people directly about their reasons for joining a gang, we tend to see very common things come up. Protection is definitely a top factor that is cited by a lot of young people, and that could be protection from violence in the neighborhood or violence from school, violence from rival gangs. And it could include bullying. It could include family violence. So protection is one for fun. Young people lacking something interesting to do, they cite that as a reason. Gangs are exciting. There's usually something going on, or if there's not, they create it. Another factor would be, let's see, fun. Oh, because a friend is in the gang. So social reasons, friends being in the gang, or importantly for a lot of young people, a family member was in the gang. And then a fifth reason that many young people voice is to get respect or to feel like they belong and they have some status. Young people, you know, everyone has a need for identity and a need to feel like we belong and that we are respected. And so those tend to be common reasons. When we look at qualitative research, these are, you know, when we actually sit down and talk to young people about their life histories, about what's happened to them, we start to see a little bit different picture emerge in that young women who are in gangs tend to come from more chaotic households than do young men. It's more likely that their families are in poverty, that there is household violence, that they themselves have experienced physical and particularly sexual abuse. There's likely to be mental illness or substance abuse problems within the household. And this is not to say that young men don't have that in their backgrounds, but for young women who find themselves in gangs, we tend to see that it's exacerbated, this household and family experience for young women.
When we think about gangs just as a whole, I think that the thought is that the members are heterosexual. I think that's the common view of the broader society. But what do you think? What do you know?
That's an interesting question, because I don't think we really ever think about it. It's an assumption that's an inherent assumption. The assumption is of heterosexuality in our society, and I think when we think about gangs, if we were to think about sexuality, we would think certainly of heterosexuality. We would think of, especially for men, you know, men who are in gangs are aggressive. They're very masculine. They're very manly, and to think of gay men in gangs would be really contradictory. Stereotypically, when we think of gay men and how they've been portrayed in the media, you know, historically, is that they're very effeminate, they're weak, they're emotional, and that just doesn't seem to have a place in the gang. When we think about females, I think it would be a little more likely that we might think of females, if they are gang members, maybe they're lesbians, right? Because there's more of an association of gender crossing among lesbians that they might be masculine in orientation or masculine in dress. And indeed, as I mentioned, some of our historical depictions of women in gangs, for example, the Gangs of New York movie was based on a book by Herbert Asbury about gangs in the Five Points. And he describes some of these very masculine women. And some of the researchers historically have surmised that young women who are in gangs must be lesbians. So I think for both of those reasons, we could think of maybe heterosexual males and maybe gay females being in gangs. And I think the reality is that we find both. One of my doctoral students did a really, really cool study where she was aware of gay gang-involved males, and she was very curious as to how these young men negotiate these really hyper-masculine environments. Are they out to their gangs? If they are out, do they have any negative consequences? And how do they negotiate their identities, their multiple identities within those environments? And she did face-to-face interviews with 53 young men who are gang-involved and also gay. So we get some really unique insights from that, and she and I would love to look at the variation, both sexual orientation and gender identity for young women in gangs, and we look forward to taking that on in the future in terms of our research.
It certainly sounds like it would be fascinating research. Was there anything in particular that she discovered that surprised you both?
I'm not sure that it surprised us, but certainly there is, I think other people have been surprised that, first of all, there are gay male gang members. And in fact, that was a question that she got frequently when she was describing her research. People would say, excuse me, wait a minute, did you say gay gang members? So just the fact that we would have gay gang members was surprising. But what she found, and again, it has to do, I think their experiences have to do with the different structures of the gangs. Much like my own research with the sexual composition or sex composition of the gang, she looked at the proportion of a gang's members who were heterosexual or who were LGB, and she found that there were very different experiences for young men depending on the type of gang they were in. Men who were in largely heterosexual gangs, many of them were not out to their gangs, and they felt like they could not come out. And if they did come out, they had made their name in the gang. They were trusted. They, you know, put their time in. They put the work in. They were respected members of their gangs, and it was only then that they felt they could reveal this other aspect of their identity. This compares to young men in gangs that were largely made up of other members who were lesbian, gay, or bisexual. And in those gangs, the gang kind of coalesced around that queer identity, that LGB identity. And so there was acceptance of each other's identities. And they ended up actually being rivals with other gangs, both straight and LGB, over protection of that identity. So other gangs might have considered them to be less or to be weak because there were gay people in the gang. And they found out that, in fact, that was not the case. They were not weak. They were not stereotypically effeminate. And so they were able to prove themselves. And a lot of their conflicts were around protection of that gay identity.
I think I hear the beginnings of another book or two between you and your student who's doing the research. What's her name?
This is Vanessa Panfil, who has now graduated, and she is an assistant professor at Old Dominion University in Virginia. She actually just had her book come out, and it's called The Gang's All Queer. So it's actually a really good read if anyone's interested. And yes, she and I definitely have plans to continue this research in other cities with other young people of varying gender and sexual identities.
And again, the name of her book is The Gang's All Queer?
Yes.
Okay. All right. You know, you mentioned media portrayals a bit ago, and it seems that, you know, a lot of times when you see the movies of the female involved gang member, she is sexy, she's super smart, she's everything wonderful and fabulous. And oh, by the way, either a, and actually, as I think about it, she's not typically the member of a gang. She's typically the leader of the gang, although that may be a hidden piece of awareness, you know, as the story unfolds. What's your thought about the media portrayal of women in gangs?
Well, as you've just described, I think there are some positive and some negative things there. And I think they mix and match some of the different roles. It is a good thing, I think, to see young women who are leaders of gangs. I think that could be a positive image in that young women can have leadership roles, especially in groups that are typically masculine. I think, unfortunately, the media probably does that in order to really have a hook and get people to really look and listen, because it's not something that we would typically think about. But young women do have some leadership roles, and they do they are involved in leading other young women and sometimes other young men. We've had a couple of examples, even locally, of gangs that have been led by a couple of women, and this comes out in the newspaper when they've been arrested, and I think that surprises people. But unfortunately, the negative aspects of the media portrayal have to do with that sexualized aspect and that exoticism, particularly for young women who are of color, and we tend, I think, to really sexualize them. And that's a key focus in the research and also in media portrayals, is that young women who are associated with gangs are there because they think the men are very attractive, they're bad boys, and they're there and they'll do anything to be involved in that exciting life. And I, you know, that's an unfortunate portrayal, because young women, you know, they have their own identities, they are individuals, and they have, you know, their own roles, their own lives, and their own identities, and you know, emotions that I think those portrayals really undervalue.
I know that you have done work in evaluating a school-based gang prevention program, and I wonder, first of all, if you can tell us about that work, the GREAT program, I believe it's called, but also the impact of media on those young boys and girls in school who are seeing the glamorized, if you will, life experience of a gang member.
Yeah, that's a really difficult thing to combat, is the glamorized lifestyle. And that's something that has been in the media for quite some time. I mean, when the movie Colors came out, and I believe it was 1988, that really was the first Hollywood movie, you know, media portrayal of gangs. And it helped to spread gang culture across the U.S. And then, you know, the media since then, and films and social media has really proliferated that. And it's a very difficult thing to combat, because it's very sexy, it's very attractive. And one of the ways that that communities are trying to prevent young people from joining, there are a lot of approaches that try to intervene or suppress, and we are attempting to try to get young people from joining gangs in the first place. So the GREAT program that you mentioned is the Gang Resistance Education and Training Program, and this is one that's actually taught in middle schools across the country. It's across all across the United States, and it's taught by uniformed law enforcement officials. So it could be police officers, sheriff's deputies, sometimes even probation officers or state or federal law enforcement. It's taught at entry to middle school, so sixth or seventh graders, and it's a curriculum that is 13 lessons long, and it attempts to really provide young people with the skills and information that they would need to make better choices about whether to join gangs, and in hopes, again, of reducing gang involvement. My colleagues, Finn Espenson at the University of Missouri St. Louis, he has had two different grants to study this program over a long period of time. We did a five-year-long evaluation in the late 1990s, which actually led in part to a revision of the program. And once the program was revised, we were awarded a second grant, again through the University of Missouri-St. Louis, to evaluate the revised program. We finished up that evaluation just a couple years back. We had seven different cities involved in the evaluation and over 3,800 young people who we followed from 6th grade to 10th grade. And what we found was that this law enforcement officer provided program did in fact decrease the percentage of young people who had joined gangs in those communities, or in those schools rather. It also, the program also improves young people's attitudes towards law enforcement, which is, you know, a key issue in the media right now and in our communities. So having the law enforcement officer in the classroom and interacting one-on-one helps build that relationship and break down some of those barriers between young people and law enforcement that are really important.
It certainly sounds like a powerful program. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'd like to talk to you a bit about the impact of the perception of race on the perception of gang membership. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. We'll be right back. Dr. Peterson, one of the things that has become, I would suggest, more, I don't know, energy propelled, perhaps is a way to put it, is the perception that there are particular races or ethnicities that are members of gangs. I mean, it's almost as though it's in their DNA. If they're this, then they're a gang member. What's your thought about the perhaps proliferation of that kind of perspective?
That's a good question, because I think that you're right. When we think of gangs, when someone says the word gang or gang member, images come to our mind. And probably the image that comes to most people's minds is young black or Hispanic male who lives in the inner city. And that is unfortunately a picture that was perpetuated by some of the research that has been done on gangs, and it's been perpetuated in the media. It's interesting because in the early days of the United States, when cities first formed, most of the gangs were white ethnic gangs. And here we're talking about Irish gangs, such as, again, those described by Herbert Asbury in Gangs of New York, Polish, Italian, so white ethnic gangs. Over time, we started to see more Latino, Puerto Rican, black, African-American descriptions of gangs. And this is particularly starting in like the 1950s and 60s, especially, I think, coinciding with the civil rights movement. And I think there are, you know, there are particular reasons why gangs are described in this way. I think gangs, by definition, in some communities, refer to groups of young people of color. And a lot of times when we think of whites being gang involved, we don't think gangs. We think white Aryan resistance. We think skinheads. And it's unfortunate, I think, that we have these distinctions because we tend to deal as a society with these groups in different ways. And we excuse behavior, I think, sometimes for groups of young white people that we don't excuse or rationalize for groups of people of color, groups of young people of color. Once we start to look at variations across communities in who makes up gangs, we start to see that this picture of gangs as isolated among young people of color is actually not overly correct. If we look at national statistics from law enforcement, we do see that the largest proportion of gang members are reported to be black or black African American or Hispanic Latino. But when we do self-report surveys of young people in communities across the United States, we find a good proportion of self-reported gang members are white. And we find that if we involve a cross-section of communities, if we don't focus our research on places where we stereotypically think gangs are going to be found, we find that gang members reflect their communities. So, for example, in the first evaluation that we did of the GREAT program, we had 11 cities involved in a cross-sectional evaluation, and these cities ranged in geographic and racial ethnic diversity, and we found in cities that were largely made up, the larger population was mostly white. Gang members in those cities were mostly white. If we go to communities where much of the community is African American, we'll find that many of the gang members are African American. So I think that's a really important point that hasn't been advertised and really integrated into our thinking about gangs, is that gangs are the young people of our communities. So whatever our communities look like, that's generally what the gangs in our communities look like.
I think it would be so important. I think it would be really important for parents and educators and lawmakers and you name it to really grasp what you've just described, because again, as you said, there are so many myths and prejudices about who looks like a gang member that even we put our own safety at risk when we decide that mm-hmm. he must be because he looks this way, she must be because she looks that way, or they're not because they look that way. It does right. none of us any good whatsoever.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. And I think that it exacerbates, poor relationships between law enforcement and communities and young people in those communities. It makes us miss opportunities where we could help young people who are struggling. If we are thinking that the problem, if we can call it a problem, is located within particular subpopulations, we miss opportunities. We miss opportunities to really think about how we can use our community resources in ways that benefit young people towards positive development.
You compare the experiences of Pakistani youth, Moroccan youth, Russians of German descent in Germany with the experiences of second-generation Mexican-Americans in Los Angeles. How so? What's the commonality between them?
Well, there's certainly a lot of differences in terms of the experiences and where young people are moving to and from and the communities that they arrive in. But one of the common things that we would say is that when groups arrive in new communities, they tend to have some similarities in their experiences. And that would include some resistance, some sense of being unwelcome, and harassment and violence. So this happened to white ethnic groups coming to the United States for the first time in the late 1800s. This happens today with immigration from Mexico or El Salvador. We do find that the young people in those communities find themselves discriminated against, they're harassed. Young people in general, I think, they tend to be a bit mean to each other, and this is in the general adolescent populations. And so these young immigrants or second generation immigrants in schools find that their needs aren't being met. They find that they feel like they are outsiders, that they're multiply marginalized, that they don't fit in. They don't fit in within American culture, and they don't fit in with their home culture. Because they're a bit caught in between. They want to try to fit in, but the people in their new community don't really make that a possibility. And so we find that a lot of young people feel that they are on the outside, and they will group together. People have a need for identity and belonging, and to feel that they are important and they're valued. And if they don't feel this way in their schools or their families or their communities, they'll find it in each other. And so I think there are some commonalities among people who are moving to communities where they're not fully welcome.
One of the things that comes through, at least for me, in our conversation today is the fact that with knowledge, we gain perhaps compassion. And that is not to say that bad behavior isn't bad behavior, because it is. But with an awareness that these gang members are people, they're human beings just like you and I, that they have likely experienced some sort of trauma that takes them to this particular lifestyle, I'm hopeful that is helpful to the broader population in understanding how gangs happen and what we can do as individuals and communities to combat that.
Yes, I'm hopeful as well. And I think that knowledge does breed compassion. And I think that people who work with gang members, who are practitioners working one-on-one, really see that. If they take the time to talk to a gang member, or if school administrators or teachers take the time to make a connection, you really do see that there's an individual there who has had a lot of probably negative life experiences and hasn't had some of the resources that maybe some of their peers have had in trying to cope with or rationalize or even, have resources to overcome that. The gang members are very talented. They are skilled. They are very, many of them are very funny. They have a lot of creativity, and I think that's not tapped into. I think that we don't see that. We have a very us versus them mentality. And quite honestly, sometimes their negative attitudes when we interact with them put us off, and it pushes us away. And I think if we can overlook that and try to make that connection, if we can give respect, they will feel respected and give respect back. And that's something that people who work directly with gang members will tell you, that that they're adolescents, they're young people, and they have a lot to offer, and they've had a lot of things that have happened to them. And if we can get past the attitude or the negativity and as you said, some of the bad behavior, hopefully we can make those connections and improve their lives and our communities.
I'm not sure that enough of us, and I'd be curious about your response, but it's not clear to me that enough of us recognize the need for all people to experience a sense of being respected. I'm mm-hmm. thinking that very often when we think about children, not only do we not respect them, but we don't particularly see any reason to respect them. They haven't been mm-hmm. through the school of hard knocks, or they haven't had to work or pay a mortgage or any of those things. What's your thought about that?
Yes, I think that you're right. I think that we've had varying perspectives on childhood and adolescence over the centuries, and I think right now we deny them some aspects of being an adult while at the same time expecting them to be an adult in other ways, and I think we send contradictory messages, but certainly all people of all ages desire to feel valued, to feel respected. And that can take different forms at different times of our lives. But I think if we understand that everyone has something of value to contribute, and if we can help them really bring that out and allow them to make those contributions, I think that's going to make everyone better.
The gang resistance education and training program that you spoke about a few moments ago, was there any particular aspect of that in your evaluation that stood out as being particularly powerful in helping young people to make healthy choices about gang involvement or not?
Yes, we actually did classroom observations. We sat in when the officers were teaching the programs and interacting with the young people. And one of the things that stood out kind of across all of the observations was the students really, first of all, reacted pretty well and interacted well with the officers. But one of the lessons that they really responded to was one in which they got to role play. And so they really tried to take an active learning approach and involve the young people in their own learning. But this particular exercise, they really seemed to get into. And it was one where the officer would pretend that he was trying to get the student to do something deviant, cheat on a test or skip school or have a drink of alcohol. And the student got to practice these resistance strategies that they had been taught, and they really seemed to respond to that. They connected well with the officer in that way. They really were able to run through all of the different resistance scenarios. And so again, I think it's one of those situations where if we give young people the opportunity to practice these things and to really become themselves and take on these new roles, we'll see some positive results.
For those who want to get more information about the GREAT program in particular, where do they go?
If you just Google GREAT, G period R period EAT, or Gang Resistance Education and Training, there's actually a website that talks all about the core middle school curriculum and all of the lessons, and it talks about other components of the GREAT program, such as an elementary school curriculum, a summer component, and a families component, and it'll have links to the evaluation and other information on that website.
A family's component. Now, that's interesting because, again, so many times when we see a young person behaving in ways that we may personally find reprehensible, while we may think that they come from a you-fill-in-the-blanks kind of family, I don't know that we think about engaging families in a collaborative process with the children to make different decisions.
Yes, I think that's true. We oftentimes hold young people accountable for their behavior without looking at the context in which they live. And I think the context is important. If we can't change the context, it's hard to change individuals' behavior.
Dr. Dana Peterson, I have to thank you so much for the time that you've spent with us today, really teaching us about the existence of gangs, certainly of girls in gangs, and helping to explode some of the myths that are so rampant. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to share this information. I really appreciate it.
And again,
it was wonderful.
Thank folks. We've been talking to Dr. Dana Peterson, professor at the School of Criminal Justice, University at Albany in Albany, New York. Thank you again, Dr. Peterson.
Thank you. Take care.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. Mind Talk is available to you on demand by going to myndtalk.org. You can also also download the MindTalk app from the iTunes or Google Play Store. You can also go to iTunes and sign up that way to get the daily MindTalk offerings. I'd love to hear from you if you have any thoughts or questions or comments about this or any other MindTalk conversation. My email address is Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. And again, that's mindtalk.org. And folks, remember always, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. You take care.